Hi, and welcome to another thrilling episode of Security Nation, the podcast where we talk to people who are doing really cool things to advance security, and we find out what worked, what didn't, and what they learned along the way. I'm your host. I'm Rapid7's VP of Community and Public Affairs, Jen Ellis, and with me is my amazing co-pilot, Todd Beardsley. Hey, Todd.
Hi, everybody.
How you doing?
Oh, I am great. So far, no measles, so Yay! Pretty happy about that.
For those who are not sure what Todd's talking about, other than just like being daily glad that he does not have measles, there was some sort of measles outbreak recorded in Vegas, where we have just been for the Hacker Summer Camp.
If you were there just for DEF CON, you don't seem to have any exposure. If you were there for Black Hat, you almost certainly do.
So here's the thing that's annoying, is that I have conference plague regardless. I don't think I have measles. I wasn't even really at Black Hat long enough to have measles. I just have a nasty cold, which is lucky for all of you wonderful listeners. You get to listen to me sound snotty. Yay.
Well, hopefully anyone listening to this already has their vaccinations. If not, go get vaccinated.
Also, you cannot catch measles through listening to a podcast.
You cannot.
Just to be clear. I'm not a doctor, but that is a thing that I know. Okay. So before we get into our interview, which this week is with one of my heroes, Wendy Nather, we're gonna have a little chat about the rapid rundown. We were just talking about Vegas, so like, why don't we start there? Did you enjoy your Vegas extravaganza?
I had a great time this year. Some years are better than others. This is one of the better years.
Oh, you did well at the tables? Is that what you're telling us?
I did okay at the tables. I lost very little. But I think mostly the big reason why I had a great time was because I managed to catch like not one, but two keynotes. And they were both great because they're keynotes. So they're supposed to be great. The first one I saw was Bob Lord at B-Sides. He kicked off B-Sides there with a great keynote. Bob Lord is now I think he's a CISO. I think that's his title, but he's effectively a CISO at the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. And he talked a lot about how those challenges are shaping up for him. As we all know, election security, voting security is kind of top of mind for a lot of people right now. He's got a whole lot of like fancy CISO background, but it pretty much boils down to some kind of core fundamentals on how to avoid getting hacked if you're running a campaign. And that is, have your patches all up to date, please. Have 2FA and have some modicum of anti-phishing training. You hit those three things, you're 80% of the way there. You know, there's tons of fancy stuff to do for that last 20%, but boy, it's getting serious about fundamentals. It's kind of the name of the game at the DNC and honestly everywhere else. Like, if you are able to hit all of those things, then you can move on to things like, you know, having decent network segmentation is pretty nice to have, you know, vulnerability management, asset management, all those things. So hit those fundamentals was pretty much the theme of Bob's keynote there.
Nice. I like it. I like the simple message. And I think, as you said, Bob does have some pretty amazing credibility, good resume. So if he says it, it must be true. For people who want to catch that, B-Sides generally puts videos of their talks online, free and available on YouTube. I just had a quick look. It doesn't look like it's up yet, but like, keep looking because I think it will appear.
They tend to be pretty quick. They tend to have them up, you know, within a month or so of whatever the event is. And then I also saw Dino's keynote at Black Hat. It was pretty great. There was a allegory about how parachuting technology advanced in a very short amount of time. And it was all because the movers and shakers there were themselves skydivers. They had tons of skydiving experience. And so the analogy here is we can get security tons better if only we recruit people in that dev cycle. You know, moving security to the left was kind of the theme there of, it's not enough to like have a security department. You also need advocates in your development and, you know, product engineering and web app development and all that, you know, getting security kind of built in. I mean, and we've talked about this for years and years and years, you know, but I think we're at a point where it's not totally alien anymore. Like, when I talk to security people, I generally get the sense that people are aware of things like SQL injection, cross-site scripting, you know, in terms of like web app stuff. You know, for other regular developers, like, we're seeing more and more framework usage. So you're not, you know, inventing the same thing over and over again and injecting the same bugs over and over again. So that was, for me, I mean, that seemed to be the theme of the Black Hat kickoff of let's hold hands with those dev folks and work together and make security real.
I love that. I mean, I'm a huge fan of embedding security into the engineering process. I think it is it is a necessary step forward. And I like the fact that Dino is sort of talking about how you pragmatically do that. Like, you know, where do you start is always a challenge. I think people get very frustrated with feeling like they're talking to themselves or speaking a different language. So this idea of sort of, you know, finding people who are already interested or already motivated and making them into your champions is a great one. I love it. Very cool.
Yeah. And the fact is that they're the experts, right? So, I mean, it's a matter of getting those experts on your side and promulgating, you know, security mindset among the folks that they're, you know, bringing on, especially for like new developers. You know, like we've been looking at how is security doing in academia, and it turns out like it's not a core requirement in many, many CS programs or EE programs or anything like that. So getting that first job as a developer, hopefully there's somebody there already who has some security smarts and will tell you how to do it.
And as you said, Bob and Dino, two very smart, very well-respected security guys. So maybe we should try and get them to come on sometime in the future.
Hey guys, I know you listen.
Right, obviously they never miss an episode. Yeah. Who would?
So in other news, in non-Vegas related news, you know, we're still on Blue Watch. That is the coming storm in RDP, the remote desktop protocol. As listeners of this podcast have heard before, I've been, you know, pretty worried about this. There is, of course, Bluekeep, which is now about 100 and something days by the time you hear this out of the gate. You know, it's shocking. Every day I wake up surprised that there hasn't been some RDP meltdown on the internet. Lots of people have their own private proof of concept, but so far, fingers crossed, like that has not leaked and turned into a, you know, massive kind of WannaCry level internet disaster event. But just on the heels of that, the reason why I bring it up now is because of what's now being called Deja Blue.
I see what they've done there.
Great. You know what? And I like naming vulns. I do. I will go on record. I think it makes it easy to talk about and fun to talk about on podcasts. Deja Blue is one of the four bugs that were recently fixed by Microsoft in the August Patch Tuesday set. It is another pre-authentication remote code execution. We used to say RCE. I guess now we say wormable. But it is, it's a big deal. And there's already research work being done on that. And so between the two of them, before the end of the summer, when does summer end? September 21st, I think.
Oh, is that the official? That's it. After that, no more.
Yep.
Okay.
You know, and we have been down this path before. We've seen RDP bugs that look super scary that never went anywhere. But I think this is different. Like, I think a lot of people are really looking at it. But on the flip side, people are very cognizant of, you know, what happened with WannaCry. There was a disaster around Eternal Blue. It was already weaponized when it came out, of course. So we don't really know like what the impact will be of whatever RDP disaster that does eventually get unleashed. There's quite a few nodes out there. They tend to live in things like point of sale systems, medical technology, again, regular old traditional networking. So if you believe that you're all patched, please check again. If you believe you have not exposed RDP to the internet, please check again. Not that that matters much. And I mean, it's a matter of patch management and asset management here, of knowing what you've exposed.
Great.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, now we're going to go to our special guest, Wendy Nader. So for this week's episode, we have a guest that really doesn't need much intro. But yet I could pretty much like ramble for hours gushingly about her. So I will try and keep it brief and just keep to the pertinent facts. So I guess this week is Wendy Nather, a certified thought leader. In fact, I think she wrote the certification for the thought leadership. She looks horrified as I say this, but it's true. It's true.
That's the Thought Plus certification, right?
Yes, absolutely. The plus is what makes it so creamy. Wendy is the head of advisory CISO services at Duo Security, which is now part of Cisco. We like to call it Disco. I like to call it Disco because I like to disco. Prior to this, she was at the retail ISAC, which was called RCISC at the time and is now the RH ISAC
thing. Now the RH ISAC, retail and hospitality ISAC.
Excellent. And in a very rich and varied cybersecurity career, you've been an industry analyst, you've been a CISO. What haven't you done, Wendy Lady? You've also guided the Lost Boys. A bit of everything.
I don't know if Rob Graham counts as a lost boy.
Oh, one of the most lost. Hi, Rob. We'll have you on soon. Okay, so we talked about the fact that you have this like majestic, varied, very impressive background.
I think the word you're looking for is sordid. Sordid.
Sordid is a good word. It is one of my favorites. What do you think is the most epic thing that you've done?
The most epic thing that I've done? Gosh, I don't know. I usually don't deal in epic. I've done some stupid things. When I was an analyst, I took a briefing in the middle of a chemotherapy session. So yeah, I've done stupid, maybe epically stupid things. I don't know. I'll have to ask people like Javad or Adrian Sanabria, who used to work for me, what epically stupid things I've done.
Now that is when you don't have good work-life balance. Since you've opened the door, you've been, you know, relatively open about the fact that you had a battle with cancer, which you hopefully, touch wood, doing well now.
As far as I know.
Good. Glad to hear it. Has that had a huge sort of impact in your gut? I've gone from very, very high level into like very serious now. Has that had a big impact on, you know, how you've thought about work and career and that kind of stuff?
So I'm really proud of the fact that since October is both Breast Cancer Awareness Month and Cybersecurity Awareness Month, I managed to combine both of them by being diagnosed with breast cancer during October. So, that was incredibly efficient of me. But I don't know. The thing is that chemotherapy is and radiation and all the, you know, and surgery and all the treatments and everything that they do to you, they have a very long tail, especially the chemotherapy. It resets your immune system and it can kick off weird conditions afterwards. So, even if you're clear of cancer, first of all, you're still dealing with the side effects of chemo, you know, far beyond for years in some cases. And the other thing is that anytime you get a pain anywhere or something weird, my oncologist freaks out and sends me for a whole bunch of CT scans. So, right. You're always more on the alert than you were before it happened.
Yeah, it's and a constant added layer of stress at the back of your mind. That sucks.
Yeah, so it's just, I think it's tying this back somehow to cybersecurity is that, you know, when the breach finally happens, you think it's never going to happen. When it finally happens, everything after that looks like a breach to you. So there we go. That's the best I can do.
That was very nicely done. It was very smooth. I appreciate that. I was going to ask you, whether when you said that there's a long tail of implications, you are in fact Spider-Man, but now it just feels.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. You know, I was not bitten by any spiders during my radiation treatment, and now I'm really disappointed.
What were you bitten by?
Yeah.
All right. So, let me think about another one. I was going to ask you if you could go back in time and give your younger self one piece of advice, what would it be? But I think it might be don't say yes to doing this podcast.
No, it would probably be do not drive yourself to the ER, which I also did once. Speaking of ethically stupid things that I did, I was in the middle of cancer treatment and I was getting short of breath and I thought my asthma inhalers just weren't working. And I went to an urgent care doctor and she did a chest x-ray and it was clear. But then she looked at me and said, I think you need to go to the emergency room and get a CT scan of your lungs right now. So like an idiot, I drove myself to the ER and it turned out that I had pulmonary emboli all over my lungs. So, you know, theoretically, I could have keeled over mid-drive or anything. So that's That's the one thing that I would say to myself. Don't drive yourself to the ER.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like a pretty good piece of advice. Absolutely. Okay. So,
wow, this got dark really fast, didn't it?
I know, right? And it's funny because I feel like generally, like, we tend to keep it quite light, but nope, we went right there. I dove us in there. Let's talk about security things. One of the things that you are most famous for, and one of the things that I feel like I reference a huge amount on the regular, is the work that you did around the security poverty line. I probably should apologize to you for the fact that I reference it, because I probably reference it quite poorly, but I think it's just a really great, I mean, just even the words, I think, are just a really great encapsulation of one of the big challenges that exists in security. And I think it's like just a really nice sort of terminology that people can relate to very quickly and get what you're coming from. I do always attribute it to you, but again, I may not be doing you favors when I do that.
I'm sure you are.
one of the things that we like to do on this podcast is every episode we like to have somebody on who has kind of taken on a challenge that has advanced security in some way. And I think that the work that you did on the security poverty line is a great example of this. So, you know, the idea is that hopefully it will inspire others to go take on security challenges and help advance security in some way. Can you tell us a little bit, for those who are listening who are not versed, can you tell us a little bit about what the Security Poverty Line project entailed and why you took it on?
Well, this really started when I went from working in security at a Swiss bank, where I helped to manage a budget of like, you know, $50 or $60 million, to a state agency in Texas, where I had a budget of zero. And as you can imagine, building up a security program when you have no budget is really, really difficult. But even if you do have budget, if you are struggling with IT in general for a lot of different reasons, a lot of different constraints, you're still not going to be able to do a lot of the things that conventional wisdom holds that you should be doing in security. So just giving somebody free software and saying, here you go, is not going to solve their security poverty problems. So an example is when you're working in the public sector, the taxpayers are not going to pay for you to upgrade your hardware and your software every year, you know, when it costs money to do that, both in time and in effort and in disruption, and not to mention the licensing. Taxpayers expect you to use something for as long as it works until it stops working, and then you can make a case to get something new. So we had really ancient hardware, and in fact, we were stockpiling hardware replacements off of eBay because a lot of the hardware that we had was out of support and end of life. And, you know, this just makes sense when you're in the public sector. So people don't understand. They say, you know, why don't they patch? Why don't they update? And it's a whole lot more complicated than that, because you cannot make the case for something unless it's broken. Really, really broken. And the thing is that I'm now on a patching rant, but, you know, Windows XP was a great operating system. It works just fine. And it continues to work in kiosks and in medical equipment and all sorts of places where you wouldn't expect to see it anymore. But really, why would you update a multi-million dollar piece of equipment, or, you know, when it's not built to be updated and it's working just fine? I think people, you know, misunderstand that. So there are a lot of dynamics to security poverty. When I was at 451, I did some research just on whether security was even affordable. And I started by asking people, security pros, saying, you know, let's say that I'm a CISO and it's my first day on the job and the org has never done security before, what should I buy? And I couldn't get anybody to give me the same answer twice. Everybody would, you know, say, well, it depends. And, you know, that some people listed like four different technologies. Some people listed 31 different technologies as a bare minimum. And if we can't agree on what people, what orgs need for security, how can we explain this to non-professionals? And how do we even figure out whether they can afford it? If we don't know what they should buy, we don't know what it'll cost. And if we don't know what it'll cost, how do we know that they can afford it? So that's why I think that, you know, the issue of the security poverty line is a big unspoken issue. Although when I was at one of your conferences, Rapid Seven's conferences, and I gave a talk on the security poverty line, I had people come up to me later from the audience and say, yes, that's us. Don't tell anybody. So it really is much more widespread than you would think. And that's why I think it's important for those of us who can afford to talk about it to talk about it.
Well, I mean, so it sounds like you got a pretty great response from the piece. What was the impact you hoped for?
I just wanted awareness at that point. You know, I just wanted people to be able, you know, to speak to it. And, you know, it was certainly echoed by a lot of people. But I think there's still a lot more work to be done to try to figure out how to address this. For example, there are some nonprofits that are trying to offer security services to other nonprofits because they really can't afford to, you know, to protect themselves. And now that Duo is part of Cisco, I'm going to be doing some more research on this. And in fact, we're going to be launching a survey in a few months' time to talk with CISOs about more specifics around security poverty. For example, I think that there are four aspects to, you know, the dynamics of security poverty. First of all, there is the budget, there is the money, whether you can afford to do the things that you want to do, whether you control anything. But secondly is expertise, not awareness as such. I think we talk too much awareness and not enough about expertise. As if we just told somebody about security, they would be able to go do something about it.
That's not how it works.
Yeah, that's it, because it's been working just great for the last 20 years, right?
Yeah, we've nailed it.
Yeah. So there's expertise. Do you know what to do? Even if you know that you need to do something, do you know how to do it? Then there's capability. Can you do it even if you know what you need to do? So, for example, if you cannot buy new hardware because the taxpayers say no or the legislature says no, or if you don't run your own network, so you cannot put in network-based controls when you want to do that, do you have the capability to be able to do it? Do you have enough people to do it? And then finally, there's influence, which I think is also underestimated among security, among organizations. If you're something like, Microsoft or even Cisco, you know, you're big enough that you can go to one of your suppliers and say, hey, you need to fix this, and they'll do it. But if you are a small organization, they'll either say, well, you're the only one who's complaining about this, so we're not going to fix it. Or they'll say, well, we'll fix it if you pay us to fix it. So, you know, influence plays a big role in whether you can get things fixed that you are dependent on. So those are the four aspects. And so we're going to be delving more into those and finding out how much of those aspects affect the organizations that we talk to.
So if people are interested in participating in that survey, should they contact you?
That would be a good start. I'm not sure how the survey company is reaching out to people, but I can try to make connections. But there's more, you know, to get involved in doing something with this than that, because if organizations, let's say, you know, small to medium sized organizations can't actually afford the security that we think they need, then how are we going to fix this? And if they cannot implement the security because they're sitting on top of a tangled mess of legacy hardware and software, how do we help them with that? So there's a lot more that needs to be done. And I really see it as being almost as difficult a problem as that of healthcare reform. I think that there's a technology issue, but there's also an economic aspect of it. There's a political aspect. There's a societal aspect to it. We're still blaming victims a lot instead of saying, you know, there is no way they can do what they need to do. Let's see what we can do to help them. So I think we need to make a lot of changes there. And you're a policy person. So, go do something, Jen.
Yeah, stop recording podcasts and go out and do proper work. I think you're right. And I think there's a lot more scrutiny and focus and emphasis on the healthcare problem. And everybody can relate to that. I think, you know, one of the challenges that we have in cybersecurity is that we've spent the past 30 years telling people that it's really complicated and that they won't get it. And now they're like, yeah, it's really complicated. I don't get it. And we're like, oh,
why don't
what's
you
wrong with everyone?
Exactly.
So, yeah, we have to figure out how to get out of our own ways sometimes, I think.
Very much so.
So, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me when I hear you talking about this stuff is, you know, we've been doing these research reports, which Todd, obviously, as our director of research, is heavily involved in. We call them the ISA reports, the industry cyber exposure reports. Mm. And they look at the top end of the market. So the cybersecurity one percenters, if you will.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of the reason that we're sort of fascinated always by the results is these organizations, which are the most resourced around cybersecurity, probably, you know, mm-hmm. and you can sort of safely assume that that's the case.
Like Bank of America, you know, Chris Hawk. You know, unlimited budget.
Yeah, you're looking. Sort of you're talking about the Fortune 500s, the FTSE's 250s, like those kinds of groups. They probably have the biggest budget, the most resources, very, very skilled teams, and they still get basics wrong. They're still missing things, which I'm sure Todd will happily chat about. And so, like, how do you deal with the long tail if the people at the high end of the market are getting that stuff wrong? And Todd, maybe you could just talk to some of the examples of that.
Yeah, I mean, we take a look at, you know, things like the adoption of DMARC, which is like an anti-phishing technology that has been around forever. Well, maybe not forever, but several years. Turns out it makes it really hard to like spoof, you know, the target domain out to customers. Also makes it hard to spoof that domain to like internal people. So it's a great like anti-phishing thing for internal and external. And then we see things like, you know, we see adoption, you know, of definitely sub 50% across all the cohorts we looked at. But some of them reach as high as like, you know, sub, you know, 20% have adopted this. And it's like, it's baffling to me because, yes, DMARC is hard. You have to like know where all your IT is, where all your mailing lists live, you know, all of your email hygiene has to happen. It may take a year to roll out. It is free, like in dollars. But it may take a while to roll out, but you know, it has been out there for a while. And so like, we do wonder a lot and we worry a lot about like, if the Fortune 500 can't do this reliably, like, I don't know how we can expect like the Fortune 10,000 to be able to do it reliably. You know what I mean? On other areas, we look at things like, you know, just real basic stuff. Like, you know, are you exposing SMB and Telnet on the internet? Can you please stop doing this? Turns out some regions are better than others at that. But again, we run into this problem of like, you know, I'm with you with like this awareness tack is kind of done, right? Because like major security issues hit regular, you know, mainstream news. Everybody knows about, you know, WannaCry. Like almost everyone has heard of that like big internet disaster that happened a couple of years ago. And yet we still are seeing like the effects of it out there in the world. And so I am with you on the awareness is there, but not doesn't seem to be doing much, and that also is a little depressing to me because we have been saying it's like, oh well, if only people knew how to do it and knew that this was a problem, then they would be able to deal with the problem. So I guess I'm curious to you, like my question is, if the awareness part is that solved, and then where do we go from there, right?
Yeah, well, you kind of alluded to it yourself that, you know, even knowing that you need to do something that's free can be difficult because mm-hmm. you've got to know what you have. And, you know, just because the basics are basic doesn't mean they're easy. And sure. So I think if anytime we look at something like this and go, I don't understand why they're not doing it, that means we don't understand.
Right. There's a disconnect there.
And we have to go, you know, we have to go dig in with them and say, you know, can you tell us why you're not doing this? And
ask questions.
Yeah.
Admit we don't know something.
Oh, I know. What I know. Kind of I know. Everybody take a deep breath. We can do this.
This is how you got that certification, Wendy.
Yeah. Just, you know, anytime you find yourself thinking, why don't they just X, it means that you don't understand why. And so, you know, if you pull on that thread, you will often find that there is a whole bunch of links leading back to what was a really good reason at the time. Like, asset inventory is actually really hard. And I know some Fortune 500 or Fortune 50 companies that have a terrible time with asset inventory or with logging, where they just can't get their hands on the data that they need. So I think this just proves that the problem is more complicated than we think it is. And if I may be permitted to be a little snarky for a minute, is that all right, Jen?
What? And Todd? I don't know, Todd, can we cope with snarkiness?
Yes, yeah, can we cope with snarkiness? You know, most of the people who are loudly saying, why can't they just do this? This is so easy, are researchers who have their own little lab at home and keep everything up to date.
Oh, for sure.
They have no idea how complicated it is to do this in an enormous company or even a small company where you don't run half the stuff. One time with Duo, we were, you know, we offer 10 free licenses to any small company. And I was having dinner with a bunch of small business owners. And one of them was, some of the other ones were teasing one of the CEOs, you know, about why don't you have Duo installed? It's free. And he said, well, you know, we don't have anybody to install it. And if you think about it, you know, the CEO and maybe the three other people working with him or her are very busy, you know, keeping their business afloat. Who's going to sit down and install Duo? So,
yeah.
You know, a lot of this makes sense. If you really go and ask them honestly and they tell you honestly, it does make sense. It's a lot more complicated than we think it is.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said about trying to. I know that in the security community, sometimes empathy is a bit of a dirty word. Mm-hmm. And I think it can get a bit overused for sure. But I think if not empathy, at least trying to like understand the context mm-hmm. of the world and people you're trying to persuade operate.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like that's a sort of a basic negotiation skill is like understanding their context and what they need mm-hmm. and then figuring out how you can, you know, help them feel like they're getting something like that and bring them to a point where you feel like you've also moved your needs forward.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Like when I joined one organization, they had not patched anything in 2 years because they were terrified of what would happen when they patched. And the context, the background of that is that, you know, it used to be a long time ago, system administrators administered the whole stack of what they were doing. They understood everything. That, you know, they pulled the cables, they troubleshooted the software, you know, they did everything. And so they understood the system so well that they knew what would happen if they made a change. That's not the case anymore. We tend to administer things horizontally and in silos. And
yeah.
So if you have a bunch of people, none of them really know what's going to happen on this one server if you make a change, then they're going to be scared to make any changes to it. And that makes perfect sense when you talk with the people. So getting them past that hurdle and getting the right support in place to be able to start patching and being able to respond to, you know, any complications took, you know, a good while before we could get them to feel comfortable enough to start patching. So it wasn't simple. It wasn't easy. It took a while and it did get better, but I really wish that, you know, more people would spend more time on defense in real world environments so that they would understand this.
I'm surprised that Todd has been able to hold himself back though from an impassioned plea for people to patch.
Oh, come on. Come on, Todd. Let's hear it.
Well, I mean, here's my cynical, you know, doom and gloom counter argument is that, like, well, if there is the security poverty line and people aren't doing the things, and if you're running around not patching for 2 years and you don't get owned, like, I mean, that I know there's a difference between risk and threat, but eventually, like, don't you end up, doesn't this problem end up solving itself when you get today. Like when you get when your whole enterprise gets ransomed off, like that's the point where you start doing security, you know? Like, I guess I just don't.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly the point when you start doing security.
Right. And so, and maybe that's okay. Maybe that's the time you do it. Like there's a very famous quote that I cannot attribute right now about how the internet of the future will be just like the internet of today, and that it will be just barely secure enough to do the bare minimum of what it's supposed to do.
Oh, that was Marcus Rainham.
Marcus Rainham, that's the one. Thank you.
Yeah.
Again, you have the thoughtless cert. I don't. and that's kind of the case today, right? Like, I mean, we talked for years and years about like, hey, let's not put SMB on the internet, and then eventually, things shaped up and we got Eternal Blue and PSExec and all the other things that made SMB attacks so effective. And we're starting to see a drop off now of SMB. We saw like an initial drop off, like right after the big WannaCry attacks, another big drop off after NotPetya on the internet as a whole. And it's still trending a little bit downwards. It's very gradual, but we'll get there eventually, right? Like, so does this all solve itself, and do security people, you know, kind of make mountains out of molehills about certain, you know, best practices?
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you look at healthcare, for example, I can fully imagine that, you know, healthcare organizations may have software from some third-party supplier that has to use SMB to transfer, you know, medical data. So they have to have it open. And there was nothing they could do until WannaCry happened. And then enough healthcare organizations were able to beat up on this supplier and say, you better bloody fix this. And now it's starting to get fixed. So, I think things like this are going to push when it comes down to not just a theoretical security threat, but an actual availability crisis, which is what happened with WannaCry and NotPetya. When security and availability, you know, become one, and availability is the, you know, it coincides with safety, especially for healthcare and other things. I think that's going to be the tipping point. You're right that it's, we will see that. Up until now, did organizations get the push that they needed? Was it worth it for them? If it would have cost them $1 million to upgrade, you know, 2 years earlier, because it was theoretically the right thing to do, but they didn't upgrade until now, they saved that $2 million that they could have used for operating costs. So, you know, from a business perspective, it could have been a good decision.
Okay, but here's the thing. And I know that I am a cyber hippie, and I believe in cyber peace and cyber love, and that I always come in with my like naive, but wouldn't it be great if the world worked like this stuff?
Yeah.
But here's the thing is like, yeah, maybe that company saves itself $2 million over the number of years that they don't do it. But then the potential cost to them is like that piece of IP or that, you know, that trade secret or whatever it is, like, or customer confidence. Like, it can be as simple as customer confidence, reputation. Like, yes, there are lots of cases of breaches where it isn't a business ruiner. We've seen time and time again, Target's stock price went up after their breach. More people went to the store. Target handled it obviously super well. We've also seen cases of businesses where it did have a huge cost. I think, you know, NotPetya is cited as being the most expensive internet attack ever, because companies like Maersk and Merck really suffered from getting hit by that attack. Yeah. And, you know, when you think about the impact of that, like a company like Maersk, which like basically runs shipping around the world, like there's a huge impact, not just on their business and the profit lines, but there's also, and this is where my cyber hippie piece comes knocking back in again, there's a huge impact on people, humans, you know, who don't get access to medicine in the case of Merck, and people who don't get access to the food that was being imported on a ship in the case of Maersk. You know, there's huge impact to people, to customers, that kind of stuff. And so I think there is a payoff here on the idea of sitting back and waiting, and it's not a good payoff. And so that's why I hope that people don't play that game, don't play chicken.
Yeah, you know, although if you are, let's say you're a startup, You're not going to hire a CISO right out of the gate. There are a lot of things you're not going to pay for.
What do you mean? Employee number three. Come on.
You know, you simply can't buy all of the things, you know, when you're two people in a garage. And at some point you say, yeah, I guess we should start doing that. And if you're lucky, the timing is correct. And you've missed, you know, most of the threats. But there are other ones that you just try to, business is all about timing. It's all about taking risks and saying, can we do without this for a little bit longer so that we can, spend the money here and expand here? And so this is the trade-off that everybody's making.
Well, sure. But if you're the startup today, you also like, I don't know of any, I cannot imagine a startup today, like buying rack space at a place, you know, like no one's building their own like bare metal servers anymore. Like if you're a startup, are hosting in AWS and Google and Microsoft, who do have access to like excellent security teams, excellent security processes. You're using like web application frameworks that like make it hard to shoot yourself in the foot with SQL injection. I do think that, you know, starting today, your startups do have a leg up over the startups of 20 years ago who did have to do all this stuff. Like you say, like they had the sysadmin who knew everything about everything. Now you don't have to know everything about everything, and you can farm out some of that, at least some of like the basics of security, to someone else.
Yeah, it is getting better. You're right.
Also, I think this also very strongly comes down to what is your business, mm-hmm. right? Like if you are a startup that has innovated some incredibly new technology that is a new way of doing things that is important, recognizing that the potential for cyber espionage from foreign nations that want to actually basically steal your idea and create their own and then steal your market, that's actually a pretty huge thing. And that's a different level of risk, a different level of recognizing, like, you know, the kinds of attacker you're going to be facing, for one thing. And I use that example because we had a customer that very much fit in that category of, like, they're a small startup, but what they had built was actually kind of had the potential to be an industry game changer. And definitely the kind of thing that I could see foreign players wanting to try and steal and replicate and go after the market. And so in that instance, you know, the kinds of attackers they're going to be facing with, we're not talking about like drive-by casual stuff. We're also talking about the potential for their business to survive, right? Like if they lose that sort of cherry position they have with their IP, then that's it. They're done for. Like, you know, it's, you know, if the secret recipe to Coke goes, then what is Coke? It's just a red label. And don't get me wrong. I know that I just like very much minimize the effect of branding. And in the case of Coke, one should definitely not do that. But with startups, they don't have that brand capital. They don't have the brand loyalty. What they have is that cool IP. And so, you know, you have to think about like, what is your particular risk model look like? Who, you know, what are the things that you need to protect? What is the likelihood that people are going to come after you? And what are the kinds of people who are coming after you? And then you make an informed decision about how important security should be in that context. And it's going to be low level. And for others, it's going to be a much higher priority.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're a startup with that great IP, you know, as Duo was in 2011 when it launched, you know, it was like,
well, that was nice, by the way. That was seamless.
Thank you. professional. if you are, you know, if you're a startup with that IP, first of all, are you going to spend your money protecting your IP, or are you going to spend your money getting your product off the ground? You know, it's got to be either or. And so you go along as long as you possibly can until you believe that the threat is probable enough that you need to start spending money on it just beforehand. And as you probably know, Jen, I call that the cheeseburger risk management syndrome, where you're going to eat cheeseburgers until your first heart attack, and then you're going to stop. And, you know, if we all do this with risk as humans, and if we're lucky, we see the threat happen to somebody else, and we feel that it's probable enough since it was somebody we know, that we now say, okay, maybe I better put down the cheeseburger because my friend over here just had a heart attack. That's just,
you're making me really hungry right now.
Yeah, I know. That's just how we operate. And as another CISO of a really, really large company said to me, you know, we're just another breach short of a budget increase. And if we're really lucky, it'll be somebody else's breach. So, you know, we rely on that as well. So it's a very difficult equation.
Guys, I'm so depressed right now.
It's really tough. And so the thing is, how can we make this better? How can we provide security or help organizations get security built in, onto platforms, you know, joining platforms that already have a lot of those things built in? How do we help the current ones that are stuck, on top of a big massive legacy? How do we help them move to something cleaner? I have a friend who did incident response for another enormous company that had its IP stolen. And afterwards, you know, he was trying to sell them on, you know, can we put the security in now? And they said, what for? Our IP is gone. There's no point in us doing it now. It'll just cost money and it won't help. So, you know, what do you say to a company like that? But, you know, that's what we're running up against. We don't know if companies can afford what we say they need. Can we figure that out? Can we help them get it in time? And, you know, without too many of them falling prey to these sorts of dangers. I mean, I don't even know if anybody's even studied how many shops have folded because of cybersecurity events, like how many had their investors pull out.
That would be a fascinating piece of research. I don't know how you'd go about it, but it'd be a fascinating piece of research.
I don't know. But, you know, it would be interesting to know the real scope of the problem, not what we think the problem is, because the problem is that we have, a bias as security professionals. We're kind of like firefighters. If you ran around putting out fires all day long, you would think the entire world is on fire. And so we think about and we, you know, deal with security incidents all the time, and the availability bias can come back and bite us. And we don't realize that it really isn't quite as bad as it looks to us, because we always look at the bad stuff.
Okay, so if you were going to give people one piece of advice, this is how I always end every spot with this question, what would your one piece of advice be that you would give?
Oh boy, don't drive yourself to the ER. no, I don't know. Don't write malware. Come on.
There are better ways of making a living.
if Jen asks you to do something, always say yes.
Really? Are you sure about that?
But buckle your seatbelt first.
Welcome to my career.
I was going to say, I feel like Todd would give a very different piece of advice. Awesome. All right. Well, I can't decide if you've depressed the hell out of me or left me feeling like things are not as bad as they seem and it's all going to be okay. I have to go away and digest it. So maybe we can have you back on in the future and I can figure that out. Awesome. Thank you very much, Wendy, though. It was absolutely awesome having you on, as usual, both completely enlightening and thought-provoking, and entertaining as hell to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that's our episode. Thank you so much to Wendy for being our special guest this week. Thank you to Todd for educating me on everything as per usual. And thank you to our amazing producer, Bree, who keeps us in line and also has the patience of a saint. Next episode, we'll be talking to, we have no idea. So you'll just have to tune in to find out. It'll be very exciting.